and it bounces around inside your head until your whole head is full, every inch of it, with that light. I'm moving the flippers on the machine, and the ball is pinging all over the place. Light, light, light. One of the best things about Elizabeth was the way that she willingly overlooked people's bad qualities. It was as if she could see how terrible someone was, and then redoubled her efforts to be kind to them, as if every asshole she encountered was an abused child she was trying to stop from setting animals on fire. It's how she was with Lydia, who certainly never deserved it. Andrew had never been able to equal that goodness, that generosity. It was hard to reconcile that good-hearted kindness with what Elizabeth had done, but Andrew was trying. The white light was surrounding her face, making her blonde hair glow even brighter. But Dave's cool white light couldn't seem to knock out Lydia, no matter how many deep breaths Andrew took. Kitty's Mustache was the most popular band at Oberlin. They played shows at the Grog Shop in Cleveland, opening up for bands on tour from New York and Chicago, and when they played at parties around campus, the houses would turn into glorious fire hazards, the packed rooms overflowing into front yards until a neighbor called the police. Zoe and Andrew were the same year, one class ahead of Elizabeth and Lydia, and they had endless conversations about what to do when half the band graduated. Andrew was in no hurry to get back to New York. He wanted to stay to be with Elizabeth, just live off campus and work at the bike shop. It cost almost nothing to live there, and Elizabeth could steal enough food from the dining halls and the co-op kitchens to feed them fine if the parental well ran dry. But the well wasn't going to run dry, and so Andrew wasn't worried. It all would have been easy, except that Zoe wanted to get the hell out of Ohio, and how the hell were they supposed to practice without her? They had a 7-inch already, Kitty's Mustache and the Male Gaze, which an indie label had pressed 300 copies of, and Andrew and Elizabeth were anxious to finish a whole record. That was when Elizabeth wrote the song. It was a fucking hit, there were no two ways about it. Even if Elizabeth had never shown it to anyone, had only played it for herself in her bedroom, it still would have been a hit. Songs were like that, freestanding monuments. When she came back to their practice space from the library, she played it on the guitar and sang with Andrew, Lydia, and Zoe all sitting on the floor in front of her. Lydia drummed her sticks on the floor, keeping time. By the time Elizabeth got to the second chorus, Zoe was on her feet, singing along, and Andrew knew that she wasn't going anywhere. They stayed late, doing it over and over again, until their cheeks were flushed and their fingers were red. When they were done, it was midnight, and the bar in the shitty hotel across the street from Zoe's apartment would be open for another 2 hours. They walked over together, giddy. Elizabeth and Zoe got a table in the corner. Andrew went to the bar to get a pitcher of beer, and Lydia went to the bathroom, which was in the lobby. The entire first floor of the hotel stank of cigarettes. The rooms probably did too, but Andrew had never actually been in one, and stale popcorn, which was free at a machine in the corner. Zoe knew all the bartenders, enormous guys with motorcycles and terrible teeth, and every other pitcher was usually free. Andrew was buzzing. He always liked the band, and they had other good songs, including ones that he'd written, but this was different. He got the pitcher and sloshed it over to the table. "I have to take a piss," he said.
"I was dying to know that, thank you,"
said Elizabeth, who was always more sarcastic when Zoe was around. Both the girls laughed. Andrew gave them each a middle finger and headed into the lobby. The bathrooms were behind a half wall, as if the hotel were nice enough to pretend that people passing by didn't walk in and use them all the time. Andrew pushed through the swinging door and relieved himself loudly at the urinal, sighing. He walked out again, whistling "Mistress of Myself," but only made it one step back into the hall before Lydia got to him.
"I was waiting for you," she said, her eyes mostly hidden under her bangs. "Come with me."
Lydia pulled him by the hand out the front door of the hotel, well out of view of the bar. It was April and not yet warm, though the flower buds had started to push through in the park across the street.
"Fucking good song tonight, huh?"
Andrew said. He felt drunk, even though he hadn't had a sip yet, and rubbed his belly. They stood on the dark street corner, and Lydia wrapped her arms around his body. She was small, just over 5 feet, and her head fit under his armpit in a way that he liked. Elizabeth was taller than he was, and he liked that too, but Lydia made him feel like he was 30% handsomer, like the star quarterback on a high school football team.
"What's up?"
Andrew said, petting her head affectionately.
"I don't want to go back to the bar," she said. "I just want to be with you."
But we're celebrating. Andrew pulled back and put his hands on Lydia's shoulders. Come on, it'll be fun.
That's not the kind of fun I want to have, Lydia said, and she grabbed his face and kissed him.
It wasn't unexpected, was it ever? Elizabeth had teased him about Lydia's flirting, and Andrew had always said it was nothing, because it was easier than telling Elizabeth the truth. They'd slept together a handful of times, only when they were both really wasted, and when Elizabeth was elsewhere for the night. Lydia seemed to know exactly when she would be gone, and she'd present herself on Andrew's doorstep with a bottle of not-terrible wine and no underwear. They never talked about it after the fact, which made it feel less like a secret and more like a shared fugue state. It had nothing to do with Elizabeth. Andrew loved Elizabeth. She was a glass of whole milk, fresh from the cow, undiluted goodness. Lydia was something separate, something spiked. It was like Betty and Veronica. Archie loved them both, and they loved each other, too, even though they tugged him back and forth. When Andrew imagined Elizabeth finding out, that was a part of his defense. It wasn't much, but it was something. He hoped he'd never have to use it, that Lydia would just disappear one day and make his life easier. It wasn't like he and Elizabeth were married. They weren't even living together. It was worse than jaywalking, but not as bad as a root canal. Worse than throwing up in a taxi cab, but not as bad as going to the DMV. Come on, Andrew said. Let's go back.
Fine,
Lydia said, sticking out her lower lip and squinting at him.
Or I could just blow you right here.
They crossed the street into the park, and Andrew unzipped while Lydia crawled half under a bush and then pulled him to his knees.
Would that scene be in the movie?
The white light didn't exist. Andrew's head was filled with Lydia. They slept together a few more times, and then the semester was done, and Andrew moved in with Elizabeth, and it was over. Lydia swore to him that he wasn't the reason she was leaving school, that she actually fucking hated it there, and he wasn't even remotely that important to her. But he never knew for sure. That summer, he helped her load a U-Haul truck, and when she hopped up into the driver's seat, she shook her head, giving him that same look she gave him 1,000 years later at the restaurant, after Harry was born. She looked at him like he was a fool, like he'd made the wrong choice, and she knew it. It was never so clear to Andrew. Nothing was. All he wanted in life was for something to be as clear as everything had always been for Lydia. She had wanted him, and when she didn't get him, she was out. Whenever Lydia sang that song, that fucking perfect, beautiful song, it was all Andrew heard. She was calm, and she was gone, and he was left with her voice and Elizabeth's words, and Andrew was sure that he heard exactly what Lydia wanted him to. It was the thing in his life that he felt the guiltiest about, and when Lydia died, Andrew's first emotion had been relief. No one else knew, and now he'd never have to tell Elizabeth. That relief was the second thing he felt guiltiest about. It was a guilt sandwich, with Lydia in the middle. Andrew felt Salome ruffle his hair and heard her crouch down behind him. She pressed her thumbs against his shoulders, grounding him into the floor, and then she rubbed little circles on his forehead. Her hands smelled like lavender. Andrew breathed it in and breathed out as much Lydia as he could. There was always more. She was sticky inside him, a thin coating of lust and regret stuck to his insides like tar. There was never enough white light, but he kept breathing, hoping that it would change. Chapter 49. Now that her job was on indefinite hiatus, Ruby had more time for being a creeper for Elizabeth. It was fun, like pretending she was Harriet the Spy, and more than anything, it gave her something to do. The first step was going to a yoga class, which Ruby thought sounded relatively low impact in terms of spy missions. The Evolvement website was garbage, just a bunch of photos of pretty girls with their eyes closed, smiling like someone's tongue was on their clit. But there were class schedules on pink pieces of paper in a clear plastic box on the porch. Ruby put her hair in a ponytail and stole Zoe's mat from the hall closet.
"Just see what it's like in there," Elizabeth had said. "Just see if there's anything weird going on. You know, talk to people."
Ruby was on it. The classes were $15 for drop-ins. Ruby paid cash and signed a waiver under the name Jennifer Lopez, which seemed both funny and within the realm of possibility.
"Call me Jen,"
she planned to say to whoever was teaching the class, before launching into a long soliloquy about her youth as a gymnast and her tight hamstrings. The pre-planned speeches were unnecessary. Unlike most studios, which were pretty empty during the day, Evolvement was packed, and the woman teaching the class didn't even introduce herself. She was a lissome blonde, and she stepped on the tiny slices of hardwood floor in between the mats, touching everyone as she made her way around the room. Ruby unrolled her mat in the front row. She had to be an eager student if she was going to get any intel, and ohmed loudly when called upon to do so.
"Welcome to Evolvement," the woman said. "My spirit sees you."
"My spirit sees you," everyone in the class said back. "Let's do this," the blonde said. She turned around, whipped out an iPhone, and pressed a button, immediately filling the room with Afrobeat music.
"I want to see your beautiful bodies move."
If Andrew was in trouble, it certainly wasn't with this idiot. Ruby did as many upward-facing dogs as she could before collapsing onto her mat and waiting there for the class to be over. When they were all rolling up their mats, Ruby sauntered casually up to the teacher, who was drinking a tall glass of something frothy and green.
"Good class," Ruby said. "I ran 6 miles yesterday, and my body just needed a little break. But really good class."
The woman lifted her thumbs to her forehead and offered a micro bow.
"Thank you so much," she said. "My spirit could tell that your spirit needed a rest. That's so important, really. It's like the number one thing that you learn in teacher training, that the hardest thing to do is to just listen to your own body and not care about what else is going on in the room."
She put her hand on Ruby's arm.
"You are my greatest teacher today."
"I feel exactly the same way," Ruby said, and put her own thumbs to her forehead. "Namaste."
She looked around the room, which had finally thinned out. There were still a few bendy-looking people loitering, giving each other back rubs, complete with appreciative moans. They reminded her of Dust and the church step kids, only with better skin and clean livers.
"This place is so great," she said. "Do you teach her a lot?"
"Oh, we're all teachers here," the woman said.
She leaned in.
"You know, I think that you could really be an interesting part of this place. I'm Lena. Can I show you around? Want some kombucha? We make it here. It's so good. Have you had it before? It's kind of like iced tea, only funky."
"I'd love that," Ruby said, trying not to ignore how sore her thigh muscles were when they started climbing the stairs.
Chapter 50. The tops of Dr. Amelia's feet were tan, except for the crisscrossing flesh that had been hidden underneath the straps of her sandals, which made her look like she was sitting in the shadow of Venetian blinds. Zoe thought someone ought to tell her that her whole body needed SPF 30, not just her face and arms, but it seemed awkward to give a doctor medical advice, and so she kept her mouth shut. There was a lot that Zoe wanted to keep her mouth shut about. She knew that Ruby and Harry had been fooling around whenever they thought she and Jane were asleep, and she didn't care. She and Jane had been fooling around whenever Ruby was out, which was like when she was a baby, and they'd have sex during her naps because they were too tired and or busy after she went to sleep for the night. She didn't want to tell Elizabeth about Jane, which was ridiculous, because Jane was her wife and Elizabeth was her friend, but Zoe was worried that Elizabeth would be disappointed if she and Jane stayed together, like she was chickening out. Dr. Amelia liked to sit cross-legged in her Aeron chair.
"How's it going, guys?" she asked.
"Seems like it's been a good summer."
"We just had a fire at the restaurant," Jane said. "The restaurant itself, actually."
"And Ruby still hasn't gotten into college," Zoe said, and then corrected herself. "Isn't going to college, I guess."
"And she got hauled into the police station for having sex in Prospect Park," Jane added.
"Oh," said Dr. Amelia. She wrote something down on her notepad.
"And are you two getting along? That seems like a lot of additional stress."
"We are," said Zoe. She looked at Jane, who was sitting to her left. Jane hated therapy. Her mother was a therapist and had seen patients in her home office in Massapequa, and it had soured her on the whole thing. All those afternoons when she and her siblings weren't allowed to watch television because the den was connected to her mother's office with French doors. But now Jane looked completely happy to be there, even smiling for no particular reason.
"And have you talked about the problems you were having? It's great to get in a good spot, of course, but I want to make sure that it's not just a passing mood. Have you two spoken about the issues that caused the space in the first place?"
Jane closed her mouth.
"Well, we hadn't really had time," Zoe said.
And they hadn't. After the fire, there was a lot of busy work to be done, and meals to be cooked, and they were two seasons behind on Damages, which they were watching on Netflix. Every day Zoe thought about having a talk, but every day she thought better of it.
We've been really busy, Jane said. And plus, I don't know, it feels like it would be a jinx or something. Rock the boat, you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, Dr. Amelia said. You're afraid to frighten the natives, to muddy the water, to poke the bear. She tapped her pin cap against her chin.
Right. Jane clasped her hands in her lap. Something like that.
Well, Dr. Amelia said, why don't we start now? This is a safe space, remember, and all feelings are valid. Zoe, do you want to start?
Okay, Zoe said.
She crossed her legs one way, then switched. Her hair was in her eyes, and she tucked it back behind her ears.
I guess I feel like things have been going really well, but maybe my fear is that it's because Jane is maybe afraid of being lonely, and so she's more interested in me right now than normal. And in a little while, it'll just die down again, and then we'll be right back where we were.
She covered her eyes.
Don't kill me, she said to Jane.
I'm not going to kill you, Jane said. You're right. I don't want to be lonely. But the reason I don't want to be lonely is because I love you. It's not just that I want to have someone around. I want to have you around.
She rolled her eyes.
You're really making us do this here.
Jane cleared her throat. I think we should talk about Elizabeth. Zoe was genuinely surprised.
You're joking.
I'm not saying it's sexual, Zoe, but I do think there's some weird stuff there. Is that a thing, Dr. Amelia, even if it's not about, like, doing it?
Of course, Dr. Amelia said. There are all kinds of betrayals, physical, emotional, spiritual. What exactly do you think is going on, Jane?
We used to fight about this years ago. I just think that Zoe has someone else to go to for whenever she's upset or happy or whatever. I know it's not as big a deal as it used to be, but still, I think that it's messing with us. There's a reason people don't live close to their parents, you know, or next door to their best friends. It's weird. People need space, or at least I need space.
Zoe scrunched up her mouth. Space was her line.
What? Jane said. Do you really think I'm so off base?
Dr. Amelia waited expectantly, her toes wiggling with excitement.
I think that's completely ridiculous, Zoe said.
And then she tried to slow down and think about whether or not she actually did. She felt herself heat up for an argument, the way matadors probably felt before striding into the bull ring. The more she thought about it, the more she realized that Jane was a lot like a bull, angry and immovable, sharp and prone to snorting. Zoe knew that it wasn't only Jane's fault, though, whatever happened to them. And maybe she was right. Zoe thought about all the times she'd gone to Elizabeth instead of her wife for any number of reasons. It hadn't happened that often recently, except to talk about the house, really, but years ago it had happened all the time. When she and Jane were first together, she and Elizabeth had been inseparable, and Zoe had often started sentences,
"Well, I was just telling Elizabeth," or "Elizabeth just told me," which was obviously tedious and annoying.
She thought about how she would feel if Jane had someone like that, a confidant she really loved, and if that person lived next door. They weren't in college anymore. They weren't Jerry Seinfeld and his bachelorette friends, always popping in and out with no notice or reason. They were adults, with families and taxes and mortgages. Zoe had the horrifying realization that her wife might be right. The specifics were all wrong, but Jane was right that Elizabeth had always been there, hovering at the edges, eager to answer the phone.
"I think we should set up a few more appointments," Zoe said.
Dr. Amelia nodded and made a note. Chapter 51. Dave could surf. He was from Southern California, as Andrew had suspected, and Andrew agreed to give it a try. Dave had a friend who rented boards and wetsuits a few blocks from the hotel property, and they had everything they needed in 15 minutes. He recommended a 9-foot foam soft top, and Andrew nodded like he knew what that meant.
"We're gonna get you right up, man," Dave said.
He'd taken a lesson once before, when he and Elizabeth went to Hawaii for their honeymoon, which was otherwise nothing but reading paperbacks in the sand, stopping every now and then to kiss each other and twirl the rings.
More than anything, Andrew had spent his days feeling lucky. Lucky that Elizabeth, so light and good, had chosen him, this lump of coal. He was sure from the start that he didn't deserve her, but he was going to try. And that was how they'd spent their honeymoon, having sex and getting sunburns and walking nowhere, holding hands. Maybe they should go back. Maybe Harry could stay at home. He was old enough. Andrew was still upset about the movie, but maybe if he looked deeper into it, he could see what she was trying to do. They, Evolvement, Andrew, Dave, the Waves, whatever they were going to be called, had made an offer on the hotel. There was some due diligence zoning work to be done, so the process would take a few months. Dave and Philip were taking care of everything. The first check had gone to the realtor's escrow account, along with some other money from investors, where it would sit until they signed the contract. In the meantime, Andrew had written a second check, this time straight to Dave, for another $50,000. Evolvement was growing so fast. They needed money to pay for the teachers and for the equipment, cases of bottles for the kombucha and reams of plastic cups for the juices, and to continue to make improvements to the house, and all of Dave's capital was earmarked for improvements to the hotel. He'd asked so sheepishly, as if Andrew would object, when Evolvement was the clearest and easiest of all his responsibilities. Together, they paddled out into the water. Andrew quickly remembered the feeling from so many years ago, all those dormant muscles in his chest and shoulders suddenly squeaking awake. It was hard to keep the board flat underneath him. He felt like a weeble wobble, only with no weight keeping him down. They made it past the break, and Dave gave him a few pointers. Not to try to leap up to stand, but to sort of drag his feet into place, which sounded easier, but wasn't, not really. Leaping was for people like Dave, whose stomachs were circuit boards of muscles, each tiny piece clicking together with purpose.
"It's not about instruction," Dave said. "It's just about feeling it, you know? The wave, the vibe. That's what surfing is all about. The ocean tells you when it's your time, and then you go."
"Right," Andrew said. Nearby, a surfing school was teaching lessons, and three girls in matching wetsuit tops and bikini bottoms giggled as they watched one another slide off their boards and into the shallow water. A large wave began to roll in, and Dave nodded at it, squinting.
"That's mine," he said, and began to paddle.
He was on his feet in another minute, his back flexing as he shifted his weight. Andrew was on his stomach, bobbing up and down with the waves. August had come so quickly this year. The city was empty, but the beaches were full, dotted with people young and old. Andrew wished he'd taken Harry to the beach more as a kid. They went every so often, maybe once or twice a summer, but that was it. It struck him as a grand injustice, a wrong he had done. The kids playing on the sand were digging holes. They were building castles with plastic buckets. Harry was just like Elizabeth, prone to indoor activities, and Andrew thought it was all his fault for not intervening. They'd never gone camping without a car. They'd never driven a Winnebago. They'd never gone down a zip line or made a bonfire. Andrew wanted to cry, thinking of all the things he deprived his son of, just because he hadn't thought to do them. Up ahead, Dave had easily coasted all the way to the sand. The water was shallow, and by the time Dave reached the beach, he was just skimming the ground like he was on a giant skateboard, which he sort of was, more or less. It looked so easy. Dave was probably 35, and Andrew wondered if he'd ever been married or if he had any kids. He surely would have mentioned a kid, unless it had been in some seriously bad situation, and they weren't in touch, and Andrew couldn't imagine that being the case. Dave seemed like a bachelor in a good way, unencumbered. A slightly bigger wave rolled out from underneath him, and Andrew pushed himself up so that he was straddling the board again, his legs dangling in the water on either side. Dave waved from the beach and shouted something that Andrew couldn't hear. He turned around to see what was coming. Surfing was sort of like fishing in a lake. Lots of waiting and watching, only with an increased likelihood of drowning. There was a wave coming, and Andrew decided to paddle. He flopped back onto his stomach too quickly, and it stung, but he didn't have time to think about it. He started to paddle and paddle with his head and chest up, just like in yoga class, until the wave was underneath him, and the board was doing what it was supposed to, keeping him and the wave apart. For a second, Andrew was doing it. He dragged his feet to a low crouch, and then pushed himself up to stand, almost. His knees were bent and his arms were out. He felt like Philippe Petit, walking between the twin towers. Andrew wanted to look for Dave and give a thumbs up or a wave, but he knew that if he did, he would fall. But then he started to fall anyway, and as he was falling off to the left side of the board, Andrew looked toward the beach and thought he saw Harry and Ruby standing just behind Dave, her big curly hair wound up like a ball of yarn on top of her head. But then he hit the water, and he went for a short ride in the Atlantic Ocean washing machine, and when his head popped back up, they were gone. Andrew grabbed the board and used it to kick the rest of the way to the sand.
"You totally had it," Dave said, offering Andrew a hand. "Next time will be even better."
"I thought I just saw my kid," Andrew said, looking around the beach. There were tons of young people on the sand, lying around with supermarket gossip magazines and cheap beach umbrellas, but he didn't see Harry.
"I swear he was just standing right behind you."
"Like a vision," Dave said, nodding.
"Far out."
"No, I mean he was standing there, right there." Andrew pointed, as if the sand would offer a map.
"I get it,"
Dave said, his mouth flat, his eyes blank. So there it was. He didn't have kids, Andrew could tell. He was looking back at the water, his board sticking straight up toward the cloudless sky overhead.
"Want to try again?"
"Sure," Andrew said. He took one last sweep of the beach, looking for Ruby's hair, but still didn't see them. She was trouble, just like her mother, and Andrew was tired of pretending not to care.
"Let's do it,"
he said, and threw his board back into the water, forgetting that it was still attached to his leg, which made him stumble and fall in the low, foamy surf.
"It's cool," Dave said. "You're getting the hang of it already."
Andrew was embarrassed, but didn't let it show.
"Let's go again."
Chapter 52 Elizabeth sat on the porch, sweating. She had an appointment that afternoon with a couple from Carroll Gardens who wanted a house in the neighborhood. They had a 3-year-old daughter and were pregnant with another. Zoe's house was exactly what they were looking for. Big enough for all the people and their family, but shabby enough that they could afford it. Deirdre had a listing for a house on Ditmas Avenue, but Elizabeth knew they wanted to be closer to the park than that. A few blocks made all the difference sometimes. It wasn't unusual to have clients who gave you exact borders that they were looking within. Sometimes it had to do with school zones, but sometimes it was just personal preference. If Elizabeth ever moved, she would want an apartment on Commerce or Grove or Bedford in the West Village, a tiny little tangle of streets. Not that she wanted to move, it was just a professional hazard, seeing how other people lived their lives and measuring against your own. She also didn't really want to sell Zoe's house. It would mean that Zoe was actually leaving the neighborhood. And if they weren't neighbors, what would that mean? Would she regularly text her for a last-minute dinner date? Not that Zoe had responded positively lately. Though, of course, they were sorting through a lot, what with the fire and everything. Sometimes excuses weren't excuses. If Zoe moved, would they sit on each other's porches and drink wine? How often would Zoe get on the subway for her? She didn't want to have to find out. Elizabeth was sitting on the porch because Zoe was avoiding her. She wasn't responding to emails and texts, as if Elizabeth didn't know that she'd seen them. Sometimes she longed for the olden days, when you had no idea whether anyone had listened to your message, or that you'd called them 6 times in one day. Elizabeth wasn't trying to be a stalker. She actually needed to talk to her. She promised her clients that she'd ask about the likelihood of the house coming on the market. But even more than that, she wanted to know about Jane. Of course, it was all the same conversation, and one that Zoe was clearly trying to avoid. But being neighbors, in addition to friends, meant that Elizabeth knew when Zoe and Bingo were going to take their late morning walk, and it wasn't breaking any kind of protocol to be sitting on her own porch at the same time, was it? She saw Bingo first, his happy mouth open, with his leash dragging behind him on the sidewalk. Dogs were gloriously uncomplicated creatures, food and play and sleep and love. That was all they needed. People were so much worse. Zoe was a few yards behind Bingo, looking at her phone.
"Hey," Elizabeth said, coming down her steps.
"Oh, hi, I was just about to call you back,"
Zoe said, and tucked her phone into her back pocket.
"Hold up, Bing."
She bent over and picked up the end of the leash. "Is everything okay?" Elizabeth squinted and shaded her eyes with her hands.
"With us, I mean? Did I do something?"
"What? No, what would you have even done?"
Zoe looked at the ground.
"I'm not sure," Elizabeth said. "That's why I'm asking."
No, Zoe said. Really, we're fine. Things have just been hectic with the fire, you know.
Of course, Elizabeth said, dropping her hands to her sides. It just seemed like things were weird, and we hadn't talked about the house in a little while, and then the other day with the pancakes, you and Jane seemed.
What? She is my wife, you remember.
Zoe sounded defensive. Of course, no, of course. I just thought, you know, that you guys were having some things, and we talked about the house, and I thought maybe there'd been some backsliding there.
Backsliding? You're saying that me and my wife are backsliding into our marriage out of your greedy little hands? God, Lizzie!
Zoe shook her head.
Maybe she was right. Is that crazy? I don't know. You honestly seem to be thinking more about your commission than our friendship, if I'm being honest.
No, Elizabeth said. That's crazy. That's not what I meant. I promise. Everything was coming out wrong. Elizabeth wanted to tell Zoe that she was afraid of her moving away, afraid that she would want to move too, to the apartment next door, just to make sure that they stayed friends for the next 20 years and the 20 after that, that she was sad about the idea of Zoe and Jane getting divorced and sad about her own marriage too, that Ruby and Harry were getting too old to be called children, and what did they call them next? But her mouth wouldn't work right, and none of it came out.
Just no, really, Elizabeth said. I promise.
Can we talk about this later? Zoe gestured to Bingo, who was relieving himself on the sidewalk.
Sure, Elizabeth said. I didn't mean anything by it, and of course, I just want you to be happy. And I'm not trying to sell your house out from under you. I just want to make sure I know what's happening. If you're telling me to pump the brakes, I will pump them, okay?
Okay,
Zoe said, a wistful look crossing her face.
It's just like everything is all fucked up right now, both good and bad. And I don't really know which end is up. I'm sorry.
She leaned over and gave Elizabeth a kiss on the cheek.
I'll call you.
Great, Elizabeth said. Please do. Her clients could go live in Deirdre's listing. She didn't care about that. And she did hope that Jane and Zoe would work it out, sort of. They weren't like some of the couples she knew, who she actively thought should get divorced because they fought in public so much. They were somewhere on the middle of the scale, which is how she thought of herself and Andrew. They weren't lovebirds like Zoe's parents, or even Deirdre and Sean, couples who rubbed each other's backs for fun without being asked or complaining that they really needed a massage, too. Most couples she knew were in the middle, slogging it out. Don't get divorced! That was their shared motto. It was the only way to have a long marriage, the only way to have a truly solid family. Who needed happiness when you had stability? Wasn't that the idea behind ferberizing babies? That a few nights of misery led to more sleep for everyone? Elizabeth looked down at her hand and realized that she was clenching her fist so tightly that her fingernails had left deep impressions in her palm. Some people were the levers and some were the left. Zoe was the former. Kitty's mustache began to die when Lydia dropped out, though it didn't seem like it. Lydia had always been their weakest link, and Zoe's girlfriend at the time had a friend in the conservatory who played drums, and so that was an easy replacement. The only problem was that the new guy was a much better musician than the rest of them, which made their songs sound rinky-dink, amateurish. Nevertheless, they played parties and shows all that year, even after graduation, when Zoe and Andrew were both otherwise unemployed and unoccupied. It was January when Zoe again decided that she'd had enough. She was tired of playing for freshmen clutching their first red plastic cups of beer. There was no one interesting there anymore, she said. She said that she felt old and pathetic, which was hilarious, because the whole town followed her around like she was the Pied Piper. Maybe that was a problem. Being the coolest person for miles meant that there was no one to look up to. She knew that music wasn't for her. She wasn't one of those kids who wanted her parents' life. Zoe started spending more and more time with her art professors, drinking wine at their kitchen tables and talking about New York. When winter break rolled around, she announced that she'd had enough, and that they would see what happened with the band in the spring when Elizabeth and Andrew were out of school. It was a hiatus, that's what they said to all their friends. But there was no such thing as a hiatus for a college band. Elizabeth was saddest of all, because she knew that she'd probably never be in a band again, not a real one. College was a make-believe place, where you could decide to do something and just do it, where no one was going to tell you that you weren't good enough or talented enough. Elizabeth had plenty of self-confidence, but she knew her limitations. What was a year? When they were in school, it seemed like something.
Zoe was older and wiser, which is how Elizabeth always felt, like the sound of music, and she was Liesl and Zoe was Rolf, and they were dancing around that gazebo together, minus the Nazi part. It was so funny being a parent and realizing what a year actually meant. A year was nothing, and a school year was truly nothing. You could be born a day apart and be in two different grades, depending on the date. It was also arbitrary. Elizabeth wished she'd known that earlier on in life. Zoe wasn't any wiser than she was. A year wasn't a long time. She was just bored in Ohio, and that was the end of Kitty's mustache. There was a girl in New York, of course. Zoe was never without one for long. This one was an artist and had been known, and much admired, for walking around the Oberlin campus wearing only a pair of overalls. The girl wanted to start a new band, a duo, and Zoe was gone. It hadn't lasted very long, only as long as the romance, maybe 6 months. But it meant that when Elizabeth and Andrew arrived, Kitty's mustache was a memory, not even Zoe's most recent project. It didn't matter that they'd been popular, that they'd had a record. There were so many indie labels that everyone they knew had had a record out. Everyone had show posters and music videos and a box full of memorabilia. They weren't that special. It was Lydia who later made them special in hindsight, who made them a footnote in music history. And so they all moved on, and after a few years it seemed quaint, a sweet memory to tell their children about. We were cool. Sometimes, if Elizabeth didn't think too much about the specifics, it even seemed true. Chapter 53. There was one more SAT class, and then the test. Harry wished it would last forever. He'd move into the karate studio if he had to, and take all his meals with Eliza and Thayer staring at him, chewing with their mouths open like two stoned cows. Ruby was humoring him by letting him quiz her on vocabulary flashcards. During the day, they mostly had Ruby's house to themselves, and if one of her mothers did come home, it was easy enough to wait her out. The secret truth of parenting, in houses other than Harry's own, was that parents almost always had other shit to think about, boring stuff like taxes and dermatology appointments, plus their actual jobs, and whether they needed to buy milk. Ruby told him that she'd been smoking for 3 years, in her bedroom, before either of her mothers noticed. Harry couldn't imagine ever not noticing anything having to do with Ruby. The day before, she trimmed the front half of her hair 2 inches, and it was the first thing he saw. She looked like an Egyptian queen, and he told her so.
"You make me want to shave my head," Ruby said, "just to see what compliment you've come up with."
She was wearing one of his old T-shirts. God, she could make an ancient stained Rugrats T-shirt look good, and a stretchy little black skirt. The air conditioner in her bedroom window was so loud that they had to turn the music way up, which made it hard to hear Ruby's answers to his flashcards, but Harry was reading her lips. They were listening to Otis Redding, and every now and then Ruby would jump off the bed and dance.
"Showing great joy, come on, that's an easy one. Jubilant."
Ruby rolled her eyes.
"Give me something harder."
"You can't just do the hard ones. You need to make sure you know the easy ones, too. You can't give the easy ones away. That's how you rack up the points."
"Harry, this is the SATs, not a video game."
Ruby clapped her hands.
"Let's go, next."
He flipped through the cards. Temperate, gloaming, cloister. Ruby knew them all. She got up and turned the fan so it was pointing right at her face. She had a few tiny pimples on her right cheek, and one of her earrings had gotten infected. She'd pierced that ear herself, in the bathroom at school, and the hole was still a little bit red. Harry wished that he could videotape every second he spent with Ruby, so that he could look at it in 20 years. So he could show it to her in 20 years. So they could look at it together and show their children, a boy and a girl. Twins, maybe. Was it weird that Harry was picturing twins? They'd be light-skinned like Ruby, with chubby arms and legs like him. Harry had been thinking a lot about the future. He'd be done with Whitman in less than a year. Graduation was in June. That was only 10 months away. He'd already told Ruby that he loved her, and he couldn't imagine that changing anytime soon. He couldn't imagine it changing, period. What were the rules for when the best person you knew was someone you'd known all your life? Were you supposed to pretend to look elsewhere, just for due diligence? Harry didn't give a fuck about who else might be out there. It seemed literally impossible that there was anyone else on the planet who he would like more. It wasn't anything as cheesy as having a soulmate. That was Lifetime movie shit, soft focus and hokey. It was just math. Anyone else plus Harry equals stupid. He hoped that was one of the questions. If he did well enough on the test, he could easily get into any of the city schools he wanted to go to, which wouldn't even be expensive. If Ruby kept working at her parents' restaurant, she'd make money. All they needed was a place to live. In 8 months, he'd be 18, and then his parents couldn't tell him not to see her. It was really just his dad, anyway, and Harry thought that there was a fairly high likelihood that he'd get over it soon. Harry hadn't seen his friends in weeks, and he didn't care. Maybe that's what it felt like to be in love. Ruby hadn't been hanging out with her friends either. There were girls who Harry had seen her with every day for the last 4 years. Chloe and Paloma and Annika and Sarah Dinnerstein. But other than Sarah, he hadn't seen them all summer. That seemed weirder. He didn't really want to bring it up because it might pop a hole in that magical, mysterious dream that they were clearly living inside. A world in which Ruby loved him back. But he wanted to know.
Hey, what are your friends doing this summer? Chloe and them.
He chewed on his nails.
Chloe's in Paris. Paloma's already at Dartmouth. They're on the quarter system. Plus, there was some freshman camping trip beforehand. Ugh, I would rather die a slow, painful death than go on a freshman camping trip, Ruby sighed. Everyone is gone but me.
I'm not gone. I'm here.
Harry flipped through the flashcards, quizzing himself.
I know, Ruby said, but you don't count.
Harry looked up.
Oh, come on, I don't mean it like that, Ruby said. I just mean that, of course, you're here. You're not done with school yet, and plus, you're just, like, always here.
Uh-huh, Harry said. I guess that's true. Would you rather I was somewhere else?
You're my love slave, Ruby said. This is the only place I want you to be.
She jumped back onto the bed, stuck her legs in the air, and tugged off her skirt.
Is that your way of apologizing? Harry asked.
He pulled his knees into his chest. Ruby flipped over and crawled the rest of the way toward him.
Yes.
I guess I could let it go with the warning. Just this once.
Harry closed his eyes and let Ruby take the flashcards out of his hand. They made a splashing sound when they hit the wood floor, and when Ruby started kissing him, Harry imagined all the words floating up in the air and making sentences about them, a miniature tornado of love poems. Maybe it didn't matter if Ruby loved him. Maybe his love was enough for both of them. Chapter 54. Andrew was home so infrequently, it was almost like he had a 9-to-5 job. Elizabeth took to staring out the window like a sailor's bride. A sailor's widow? Is that what they were called? A couple of the houses in the neighborhood had widow's walks, which didn't even make any sense. There was no view to speak of, except the roofs of other houses, and it seemed like offering burglars a runway. But there was no accounting for sense in Brooklyn real estate. Even when Andrew was at home, he treated her with a polite chilliness that usually lasted only a few hours. Now it had been several weeks, and Elizabeth was worried he might never warm back up. She missed the cat. She missed Andrew, the way he used to be, or the way she used to think he was. Sometimes at night, when Elizabeth was trying to go to sleep, she would close her eyes and see Iggy, his tiny little pussycat face peeking out from under a car or behind a trash can. And then he would start to look like Andrew, and she would open her eyes and stare at the ceiling, her heart beating so fast. Iggy was lost, Andrew was lost, and so was she. Everyone except for Harry. Poor Harry. To be saddled with such parents and a missing cat all at once. Maybe she should make an appointment for him to see someone. Her phone rang, the house phone, the landline. No one ever used it except the office at Whitman, or sometimes some clients who were especially anxious about something that couldn't wait until morning. Elizabeth picked it up and said hello. There was a telltale pause.
Hi there. Oops, you got me. It's Naomi.
Elizabeth looked at the telephone.
I didn't even realize that you had this number. Then again, you seem to have all the numbers, so I'm not really surprised. I'm much easier to reach on my cell phone, though.
Naomi laughed.
I'm calling for Andrew. He left me a message and I got a little excited, you know, like he's Mr. Mistress.
Andrew called you? Elizabeth pulled back the curtain again and peered out onto the street.
To say what?
Naomi tisked.
You are so naughty. I guess I shouldn't be surprised.
Her voice hardened. This was Hollywood, the swift, humorless shift toward the mercenary.
He said that he never agreed, and that as a co-writer of the song, his consent was required to use it,
and that his lawyers would be delighted to talk to our lawyers about it. He also said, and I quote, "There is no amount of money that will make me change my mind." So that's interesting, don't you think?
The bubbles came back to her voice.
Tell me he was high, Elizabeth. Tell me it was a prank phone call.
Elizabeth swallowed. Andrew was the one who was acting crazy. Why was she the only one who noticed? Why was everything her fault?
He is not thrilled, Elizabeth said.
Not thrilled with what, exactly?
Naomi said.
Spell it out for me.
My husband may not have actually signed the form.
Did I not mention that he was wavering?
Elizabeth knew she was being bad, couching her decision this way.
That presents something of a problem, Elizabeth. There isn't really a huge gray area there. If he didn't sign it, he needs to, which means we need to get him on board. You know what? I'm going to come on out. Darcy and the rest of the cast are going to be in New York next week anyway to film some things, and rather than hold up everything, I'm going to make time in the schedule for a little visit. It worked for you, and I think it'll work for him.
Naomi said something to someone else in the background.
No, it's fine, she said, coming back to the phone. This will be fine. And Elizabeth?
Yes. It was like being scolded in elementary school. She wanted to curl into a ball and roll under the bed and stay there forever.
If for some reason this doesn't work, and Andrew really does call his lawyers, I hope you've got one too.
Naomi hung up the phone, and Elizabeth burst into tears. She heard the door unlock and footsteps on the stairs.
Harry, she called. Is that you?
It's me, Andrew said, swinging open the bedroom door. Jesus, what happened to you?
The bridge of his nose was pink, a tiny sunburn. He hated wearing sunscreen. She practically had to hold his arms down to put it on, worse than when Harry was a toddler.
Nothing,
Elizabeth said. She swiped at her cheeks and smiled as brightly as possible. I was just on my way out. She stood up and gave herself a little shake, like a wet dog. Are you okay?
Why wouldn't I be?
Andrew said. He raised his eyebrows.
I don't know. How would I know?
Elizabeth pushed by him and into the hall. When she got there, she realized she'd left her keys and her shoes in the bedroom, but she hated the idea of walking back in, so she went into Harry's room and started folding dirty clothes. It was 2 years after they graduated from Oberlin that Lydia called about the song. She had never called Elizabeth directly in the days of Kitty's mustache, and so when the phone rang and Lydia's voice was on the other end, Elizabeth was on high alert. The last she'd heard, Lydia had signed a record deal. There were often pictures of her in magazines and items in the gossip column in the newspaper. Everyone loved Lydia already somehow. Elizabeth found the whole thing slightly inscrutable, but then again that was Lydia, her white blonde hair hanging in front of her eyes, her round cheeks gone narrow. She looked so different that Elizabeth bet that most people at Oberlin wouldn't even recognize her face. Her first face, that is. Maybe she'd even had something done professionally. One never knew.
Lydia, hi,
Elizabeth had said. Andrew was out. She was in the house alone. It was when she was working as an assistant for the gallerist, and it was her day off. They were still living in Zoe's house then, in what would someday be Ruby's room. Did Ruby know that Elizabeth had slept in that room hundreds of times, that Elizabeth had had sex in that room eons before she was born? She felt like she was constantly swimming through time and space, her old self and her current self simultaneously, with her flat stomach and her stretch marks and the lines around her eyes. When she thought about that phone call with Lydia, which would change both their lives forever, Elizabeth wasn't sure who was talking. It was impossible that only young Elizabeth, unmarried, rootless, beer-drinker Elizabeth, who was thinking about going back to school for social work, or maybe early childhood education, or maybe for a fiction MFA, was on the telephone, that she had somehow been the one to speak the words to Lydia. She was calling because she needed the song. Of course. As soon as Lydia said it, Elizabeth laughed.
I'm sorry, she said. Go on. We have lots of great songs, obviously, Lydia had said. There are some fucking amazing songs, but the record company doesn't feel like they have it yet, you know, the single. And
you want Mistress of Myself.
Yeah.
Elizabeth could hear how hard it was for Lydia to say it, though it must have been her idea because no one else knew the song. She must have sung it for them or played them a tape. Elizabeth could picture an office full of suits with Lydia at the center, holding up a tiny boombox, Elizabeth's voice coming out of the speakers, and Lydia singing over it, drowning everything else out.
people in the halls would have turned to look.
Okay, Elizabeth had said. As long as we get the publishing all squared away, I mean.
She heard Lydia breathing.
There is no way that I'm going to let you pretend that you wrote that song.
Even all these lifetimes later, Elizabeth was proud of herself for having said it. She could imagine Lydia's sulky mouth getting all twisted up, and she didn't care.
You know that, right?
Of course, Lydia had said. I'll get you the paperwork for ASCAP.
Elizabeth had never heard of it, but agreed.
Fine.
Great.
Lydia had wanted to get off the phone so badly, Elizabeth could tell. Even before she knew, she knew. Lydia was a snake slithering through the grass, and Elizabeth wanted to catch her by the tail and fling her against a tree.
Well, good luck with the record. What's it going to be called yet, do you know?
Elizabeth knew the answer before the words were out of her mouth. Her words, Lydia's mouth. Her words, written across a photo of Lydia's face.
We're still deciding, Lydia said, unwilling to admit it.
Okay, then, Elizabeth said. Talk to you soon. Be good.
And then she was gone. Chapter 55. Dust texted hi at midnight. Ruby was on the couch watching the Kardashians, even though it was an episode that she'd seen before. She loved them and hated them in equal measure, and if she ever applied to college again, her plan was to write an essay about them, and how she'd always had imaginary sisters as a child, even in her house full of women. Ruby thought she probably still wouldn't get in, but at least she'd be putting her real self on paper. The first time, she knew she wasn't going to get in anywhere, and so it didn't matter. If she actually tried to get in and it didn't work, then she'd be upset. A minute later, Dust texted, "Are you home? Have a present for you. Outside." Ruby swiveled around and looked out the window. Sure enough, Dust was sitting on the porch. He wasn't even facing her, just sitting on the steps as if he hadn't written and invited her to join him. Ruby stuck out her tongue, paused the TV, and went out in her bare feet. Dust didn't turn around when Ruby sat down next to him, and when she looked at him, she realized why. There was a cat cradled in Dust's arms, not just any cat.
"Iggy Pop!"
Ruby said, too loud. She covered her mouth and said it again.
"Iggy Pop!"
She reached over and took the cat out of Dust's grip. Iggy was a good boy, almost boneless, with a never-ending lust for attention, and so he didn't object when Ruby began to pet him and scratch under his chin.
"Where was he? Oh my God, Dust, they're going to be so fucking happy, you have no idea. Where did you find him?"
He shrugged.
"Around."
"Well, I'm so glad you brought him back. Harry's mom is going to be happy. She, like, needs this."
Ruby snuggled Iggy against her shoulder.
"What a good boy."
"He likes roast chicken," Dust said, "and cottage cheese."
"How do you know? How long have you had him?" Ruby asked,
even though she really wanted to ask if Dust had parents who had provided these items, or if he'd roasted a chicken himself.
"It was from the grocery store," Dust said. "My mom can't cook for shit."
"Oh," Ruby said, and immediately tried to clear her mind of all other thoughts he might be reading.
How long had he had the cat? Had he found it and just taken it home to rescue it from the streets of Brooklyn? Had he stolen it from Harry's front porch? Had he blown weed smoke in its poor little pussycat face? Ruby didn't want to know. "Anyway, thank you."
"It sucks about the fire," Dust said.
His hair had grown out a little over the summer. It was maybe an inch long, sticking straight out. In a few more weeks, it might start to look like normal boy hair and not a shaved head. Ruby tried to picture Dust with hair he could tuck behind his ears, like Harry.
Yeah, that's an understatement. Now I think my parents are happy I didn't get into college. No tuition to pay for. When the restaurant is closed, no one is buying a $13 hamburger, you know?
Ruby was afraid to put the cat down, even though he'd probably just run straight home. She wanted the points for bringing him back.
"Sarah was tripping balls," Dust said. "She thought the sparklers were fairies sending her messages. She kept trying to kneel down and get close to them. I don't think she meant to put them so close."
"Excuse me?" Ruby scooted a few inches away. "Did that bitch set my parents' restaurant on fire? Are you joking?"
"No,"
Dust said. "She didn't set it on fire. Not like on purpose. She was just putting these sparklers all around the back of Nico's house and, you know,
The fence behind Hyacinth is right there, and she put them all in a little line with some candles and stuff. And then I guess she came inside and forgot about them. She didn't set it on fire. She's not psycho. She's just kind of dumb.
Ruby had never heard Dust call anyone dumb before. That was her line. It was what she always said about him. His stupidity was the reason they weren't ever going to be serious. It was why she never gave their relationship that much thought. She'd always seen him as a cardboard cutout of a person, a type. But now she wasn't sure.
So you think Sarah Dinnerstein accidentally set my parents' restaurant on fire?
Ruby wondered where Sarah was now, if she was at home in her family's apartment in Park Slope, in her bedroom that overlooked Prospect Park. She was probably staring into space and thinking about how she could make sure she got a private room in her dorm, just in case Dust came to visit. And who knew? Maybe Dust would go and visit her. Maybe he'd take the subway to Penn Station, and then a Greyhound bus. And when he got off in the bumblefuck Vermont town where her school was, Sarah would be standing there with tears in her eyes, so happy to see him. And then maybe Dust would decide to move in with her, and he'd let his hair grow, and they'd get married and have babies, and he'd teach them all how to skateboard.
I could call the police, you realize that, right? You're not going to call the police. They probably already came. I already heard the whole thing is covered by insurance. It's not even a big deal. It could have been way worse.
Dust pulled a pack of cigarettes out of his front pocket.
Most people's houses burn down because of cigarettes, did you know that? Cigarettes and ovens.
Thanks, that's great, Ruby said. He was right, she wasn't going to call the police. What would it accomplish, except getting her in more trouble? Give me one of those, mine are upstairs. Dust plucked out another cigarette and lit it on the end of his own, the two papery embers flashing in the darkness. Ruby took it from him and plugged it into her mouth. She exhaled a string of perfect smoke rings.
I bet your little boyfriend can't do that, Dust said.
Why would he need to do that?
Ruby picked a fleck of tobacco off her tongue. Dust smoked unfiltered. Sometimes he even rolled his own from a little baggie, which Ruby had always found very sexy, his fingers working so quickly.
He's like a kid, Dust said. Like a good little kid who always does extra credit on his homework.
I do my homework, or I did. Ruby spit. Your cigarettes are fucking gross. What are you, like a cowboy?
Yeah, Dust said. But so are you. You're more like me than you are like him, Ruby. You gonna tell his parents I gave you that cat? Or are you gonna tell them that you found it in the bushes?
Dust dropped his cigarette butt onto the sidewalk, then pushed himself up and ground it down with his shoe. Did you walk here? Ruby asked. She'd never seen him without his skateboard in hand. He raised a finger and then leaned down and reached under her mum's forsythia. He pulled out his board and slid it under his feet.
It's hard to ride with the cat, Dust said, but not impossible. I'll see you, Rube.
She watched him skate away, his willowy body shifting back and forth as he went down the middle of the street. It was dark and there were cars, but Dust didn't care. He was immortal, just like she was, immune to common sense and traffic laws. Ruby finished the cigarette even though she wasn't enjoying it, and then took the cat down to Harry's house and knocked on the door. By the time Elizabeth came to the door, Ruby's sheepish, hopeful smile was firmly in place. Chapter 56 Dr. Amelia had both Zoe and Jane keep journals about their feelings. It was worse than the food journal Jane had kept in culinary school, a brag book that was intended to shame anyone else who happened to open it. Lunch, seared foie gras with poached egg and frisée salad. Jane didn't know what to write down, so she wrote down everything. When Zoe kissed her on the cheek in the morning, about half the time. When Zoe farted, often, but so did she. When Zoe said something dismissive, sometimes. When Bingo paid more attention to Zoe, always. Jane felt like it was probably stupid, but she was doing it anyway. If Zoe wanted her to do homework, she was going to do homework. There wasn't very much to do about Hyacinth. The patio was under construction. The replacement tables and chairs were on order, as was the glass that had been broken. A special cleanup crew was working on the ceiling and the wall. Jane was on the phone with her suppliers every few days. Squash blossoms, tomatoes, a new cheese, beautiful pork chops. She wanted to order it all, but they were at least a month away. During the day, she took the queue to the Grand Army Plaza Farmer's Market, buying things for the house. She always saw other chefs there, and she'd kiss them hello. Everyone knew about the fire,
Everyone was sympathetic, and they all furrowed their brows before turning their attention back to the hen of the woods mushrooms,